Netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Hi, and welcome to this FX Podcast. I'm John Montgomery, joined on the line by Jeff Huser in LA. Jeff, how's it going, my friend?
Very well, thank you.
I'm back in at our respective homes, Mike in Sydney, me in Chicago, you still in LA, I guess, after Seagraph. What a fun time that was last week,
two weeks ago. It was fantastic. I had a great time, and I think we got to see a lot of people and got a lot of good content for FX Guide TV that we'll be rolling out. And it was great. It was a great show.
In fact, there's an episode of FX Guide TV from Seagraph that's just coming out and talk with the folks at Pixar. As well as, I forget what the other thing is.
Gamma and Density.
Gamma and Density, sorry.
But no, people ought to check that out because it's kind of interesting stuff. It's really just talking about workflow tools for color calibration all the way through from onset through final. It's really cool.
Yeah, really interesting stuff. Well, we're also going to be, hopefully you'll be joining me in Amsterdam for IBC, and we'll be doing several episodes of FX Guide TV from Amsterdam. If anyone has any interesting stuff they want us to check out on the IBC show floor or maybe sessions or presentations or whatever, drop us a line at...
Parties
especially. Drop us a line here at podcast@fxguide.com, and we'll take that into consideration because we'd love to have any insight into what's coming out there. But our podcast this week is kind of picking up with the series on labor issues, Jeff, that you've been working on really hard over the last month or several months, actually.
Well, yeah, I mean, this all kind of started when we followed up on Variety ran an article months and months and months ago around the time of the last VES festival, which was about insane production schedules. And it got us thinking, and we started talking about doing some follow-up on that. And in the course of chasing down the interview you're going to hear today with Steve Hewlett from the Animation Guild was actually recorded before the one with Steve Rand. Dave Rand. This was recorded before the interview with Dave Rand and the Meteor artist who didn't get paid, but of course that one jumped to the top of the queue as soon as we heard about that. We wanted to get that story out. And since it was so related, it was kind of the perfect thing to launch this labor series. Update on that, all we know is that apparently there has been a lot of attempts by Brendan Fraser to help out the artists in that situation, to make some contacts, but I don't think any financial progress has been made in getting those artists paid.
But there certainly has been a groundswell of publicity, or I guess bad publicity, surrounding the whole issue of what went on in the payment to the artists with that in the time since our podcast.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny how these things play out, too. I was talking to an artist recently about them possibly taking a job up in Canada, and they were kind of going, yeah, but you know, now that I know how badly they protect foreign workers, I'm kind of thinking about it, and you know, if nothing else, was going to be very direct about making sure that you know, pay schedules were defined, and if a date was missed, he was out of there. So I think these things have ripples in different ways.
Yeah, exactly. It's certainly a warning to artists to make sure that you do have those things lined up and be very wary of it if you're not getting paid, in fact, because it can certainly come back to bite you.
Right. And that's kind of where Steve Hewlett from the Animation Guild. The Animation Guild represents artists. You know, traditionally started out in Cell Animation, is where the Animation Guild got its start, of course, and they represent people at DreamWorks and Sony and Walt Disney Features, Warner Brothers, things like that. They do have a percentage of their workforce now working in CGI, and they offer, you know, negotiations for you, union minimums, health care, pension plans, things like that are left to the individual if you're a freelancer, which so much of the visual effects industry is freelance. So I think what you'll hear in this interview, what fascinated me was, this is not a rah-rah, hey, everybody should join our union kind of discussion with Steve. This is hardcore, look, if you're an artist and you're a freelancer and you're selling yourself, you should know the laws and you should know the regulations and you should understand when you're being asked to do something that's outside of those laws. And we'll follow up with this. We're trying very hard to get an interview with someone from the state of California for the third part of this. And that's coming together. It hasn't been recorded yet. So we're hoping to follow up on this with that. And just starting in California, just to kind of get the bases covered with something that's local for me to track down. it's such a big topic globally.
It is such a global issue. And I want to point out, too, in the podcast, he talks about L.A. being the center and the, everything on that. He's not denying that there's excellent work and outstanding work that's being done in other markets like London and Sydney and all around the world. I think he just uses that as an example of pointing out how many artists there potentially are in that single market in the States. You know, it's, you know, we obviously have a very worldwide audience listening to these podcasts, and he's, you know, effectively using that as just saying that the market there is so big, just because of the amount of work that's being done, and not discrediting other markets by any stretch of the imagination.
Right. There was actually a great quote last night that really tied into this for me. On the Democratic Convention, Mark Warner's speech, it was a little throwaway line that got some applause, but I picked up on it. He said, "In a global economy, you shouldn't have to leave your hometown to have a world-class job." Yeah. And that just really resonated with me with this conversation, because, you know, you talk about outsourcing, and immediately everybody goes into panic mode. Oh my God, everything's going to go to India. Everything's going to go to another country, Singapore, wherever. But truly, a global economy benefits everybody in the long term. You just have to be positioned to benefit from it. And that's where, you know, the United States has kind of fallen down in some respects.
Yeah, it is. And it's a process over time, too, as well as these things even them out in the ebb and flow of economies and so forth. And honestly, they're feeling the way. And I'll be really interested in hearing, you know, the kind of the Animation Guild, what kind of things are going on like that in other parts of the world as well. I mean, we'd love to get any impact and feedback from our listeners about the kind of pressures that they're seeing in other markets like London and Sydney and elsewhere that have been changing, I think, as more and more production is being sent to all over the world, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And if anybody does have anything, contact us. You know, if you have somebody in your area that would be a good person to talk to about these issues, any perspective on this discussion. I mean, our goal here is not to set an agenda or to propose an agenda. Our goal here is, after the initial podcast, and especially after the Meteor Artists podcast, you know, we get a lot of comments. We get a lot of discussion. People come to us and they go, you know, I've heard about this and I've done this. And, you know, there's been just an amazing amount of discussion. And we want to bring light to some of those discussions and find out facts for people and find out whatever we can do to shed light on some of these things.
Yeah, it's certainly not wrong to talk about them. I think everybody does. I think that keeping quiet about these things that are going on is actually the most dangerous aspect of things. But hey, why don't we go ahead and take a listen to the interview that you had. Again, this was recorded several months ago, but again, a very fascinating thing. And I think there's a lot of really good food for thought in this interview.
The Animation Guild has been around since 1952. We were formed in the early 50s. Really started out, initially we were kind of formed the IA and a lot of high profile animation people at Disney were kind of instrumental in starting it, and there was a jurisdictional election in 1951, and the IATSC's Local 839, of which we are, became the principal representative for animation people in Los Angeles. And today, about 56 years later, we represent CGI animators, lighters, finalers. We represent animators, storyboard artists, writers working at Disney, DreamWorks, Warner Brothers Animation, Universal Cartoon Studios, Nickelodeon, Film Roman, Cartoon Network, and some other studios, but those are the principal ones. And we represent, probably we have 35 to 55% of the membership, probably even more at this point, work in CGI.
So what benefits do the members get by becoming part of by being represented by the guild?
Well, I have a couple of points. One is we negotiate contract minimums, and we also negotiate pension and health benefits. We have we're part of the Motion Picture Industry Pension and Health Plan, which has about $3 billion in it, and there are two pension plans in the Motion Picture Industry Pension Plan. One is a defined benefit plan. It's a five-year vest that if you qualify, you get a monthly check when you retire. It's really an old-fashioned, it's the old defined benefit style company plan that was around from the 40s and 50s and 60s, which has pretty much gone away today in favor of 401k plans. The other pension plan is called the individual account plan, and the companies put in somewhere between $3,500 a year, $3,000 and $4,500 a year, and that's been going up steadily. It'll probably hit $5,000-$6,000 in the next couple of years per year, assuming you work the year. For each individual employee, it's not managed by the employee, so it's not a 401k. But the returns have been about 9.5% over the last 20 years per year. So those are the two pension plans. We also have what's called the Motion Picture Industry Health Plan, which is a fairly extensive cloak of health coverage that is offered. And there are about now, I think there's about 50,000 participants in the plan, and 120,000 if you count dependents that are participating either in the health or the pension plan. And on top of that, the Animation Guild has a 401k plan that it offers separate from that. And so we have a lot of members that have a defined benefit plan, a 401k plan, and an individual account plan. So they have three pension plans. But more importantly, for a lot of people who work, they're overtime. We offer overtime, which unfortunately, it's my belief that a lot of visual effects houses basically ignore federal and state labor law and don't pay overtime for a lot of the job positions that they have. And it's not enforced, so there's very little chance that the studios on their own will pay overtime. So we make sure that overtime is paid for people working under one of our contracts. One example I can give from about 11 years ago, a young guy was working on Disney's Dinosaur, and he came up to me and said, you know, I'm a trainee here. I'm only making $700 a week. So I was making $2,000 a week at my last non-union job. So what you're doing is absolutely no good for me. And I said, okay, I understand that. Well, answer me one thing. How many hours a week were you working for that $2,000? And he said, oh, 80 to 90 hours a week. And I said, oh, okay. So let's divide the 90 hours a week into your 2,000. I said, and I did the math for him on a sheet of paper. I said, you're making less per hour than you were making as a trainee at Disney. And he looked at me and said, oh. I said, so if you break it down to how many hours you work to get that money, you're not really doing that well on a per hour basis. I said, because that other 50 hours that you're not working, although you're making less money, you can go do something else. So he acknowledged my point. And that's the thing that I noticed, that a lot of people in the non-union CGI world tend to sidestep. They just look at the weekly check. They don't look at the number of hours they work to earn the money in the weekly check. So that's a difference that I think is significant, and that's one that is generally sidestepped by most non-union visual effects houses.
Now, do you represent any visual effects artists or houses at this moment?
Well, we don't represent any houses. We have in the past. We represented people at, and it was an IA contract, but we represented them under that contract, a visual effects house when Disney had the secret lab doing visual effects.
All right.
We've also represented, under the 839 contract, we've represented various live-action visual effects that were being done by Warner's Animation. They're not doing any now. They've shrunk way down, but about 3, 4, 5 years ago, they were doing quite a bit of live-action visual effects for various movies. They were running 2 or 3 films through their shop, and now they're not. They've pretty much shut down that wing. So at the moment, The only visual effects that we're doing are for, of course, all the CG visual effects that are inside of CG animated features.
Sure. Well, you know, everything you just described, the healthcare programs, the overtime issues, I mean, I know most people I talk to in the freelance world, you know, every place they go is different in how they interpret,
right.
you know, what I consider, I would guess, are California labor laws in the specific
right.
case of California.
Right. There's an interesting thing about if you're an animator in CG, the labor statutes say the following. If you're working as an animator is in quotes, you are non-exempt, meaning that you are required to be paid overtime. Now, it doesn't define animator. An animator is in quotes in the statute. It's not even the statute, it's the reg. And I take that to mean animator. And the way the regs have generally been interpreted is if you are working with pre-built images, in the 2D world, if somebody else has done the design of the character, even though you're drawing that character and moving that character on a sheet of paper to animate it, because you are taking a design or a character or an object that somebody else has drawn previous to you, the regulations say that that's non-exempt. And it would seem to me, if you translate that same template to the CG world, where an animator in computer graphics is taking somebody else's model, somebody else's rig, and animating it, they're animating a pre-existing entity, just as a hand-drawn animator is animating maybe somebody else's design. And the regulations have always, traditionally, over the last 30 years, have said that work is non-exempt, meaning if you, and it's non-exempt because they don't consider if you're moving the object that that's creative work. The bright line of demarcation is if you are creating an image rather than just moving a pre-created image, then that's exempt work. But if you are moving a pre-created image, then that's non-exempt work, and you're hourly, and therefore after 8 hours you're supposed to be getting time and a half or double time. And that basically is ignored across the board in visual effects land. And because the federal government and the state government generally doesn't enforce their own regulations, most of these visual effects houses get away with it. And that's fine, but it's still, in my opinion, breaking rules and regulations.
Well, even your comment about 8 hours, I mean, I think most visual effects houses in California, anyway, have moved to a 10-hour day, basing it on the concept of production hours. And I've always been curious about that. I know that some have gotten in trouble and actually now
yeah.
pay time and a half
well,
after.
Well, they make it. Yeah, they make up their own rules.
Right.
And then what they usually say to employees, and I've had a lot of employees say this to me. Oh, well, you know, this is the way the industry works, you know. In other words, the rationale always began. It's not just for this kind of thing, but it's like whenever an executive at a studio is making an exorbitant amount of money compared to what any executive made 25, 35, 55 years ago, the rationale is, oh, well, that's just the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
And what the rationale for studios now is, oh, well, it's just the way it is. You know, we can ignore the rules and the regulations that the government has put up because, well, you know, we're us, and it's just the way it is, and we know how the industry works, and blah, 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 blah. Well, the thing is, if you go back to the 1920s, and I've read interviews by people who just worked on sets, and he said the rule was, on most movie sets in the 1920s, before there was any labor law or before there was any unions shoving their way in, he said you'd come to work in the morning and you'd work until you fell down. And then you'd get up the next morning and you'd do it again. You'd work a 14-hour day, a 12-hour day, and that's just the way it was. I worked for a guy at Disney who worked at Disney's from 1930 on, took a long break doing other things, and I worked for him in the 1970s, but he told me, he said, you know, people around here, Steve, say the golden age, they talk about the golden age, the 1930s. He says, hell, it wasn't the golden age for me. You know, the production manager came in at, you know, 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock on a Friday and says, who wants to work tomorrow? He said, you know, which was Saturday. And he said, if you wanted to, it was the middle of the Depression, if you wanted to keep your job, you raised your hand. And he said, you didn't get paid for it. They gave you a box lunch. And that's just the way it was. You know, I mean, the thing that happens is everybody rationalizes it by saying, this is just the way it is. In other words, we can go back to 1862 and a cotton field in Georgia, and, you know, and there are slaves in shackles. Well, that's just the way it is. You know, I mean, the problem with the rationale of it's just the way it is, well, it's just the way it is until it's not that way anymore.
Right.
And, you know.
Well, now I think there's a lot of people that are afraid of outsourcing, jobs leaving, you know, for example. My question, I guess my question is, everything you've described is the stuff I hear artists bitching about in person and in forums all the time. Why isn't everybody a member of a guild or a union, and why don't you represent everybody?
Simple. It's real simple. Now we can go back to another law, 1938, Fair Labor Standards Act, passed in 1938 as amended. And that law says you have, as an individual employee at a studio, the absolute right to organize. You can't be disciplined or discharged for organizing. It's a protected right. First time that came into existence was 1938. But how does it actually work?
Yeah, I think we all have the Norma Rae image in our heads.
Well, and that's fine and dandy, but the problem is most companies find plenty of ways to get rid of people that are problems and are trying to organize. And most people don't have the deep pockets to challenge it. And in a lot of companies, most people just go with the flow because they figure, if I really try and organize this, then I'm going to be a marked man or a marked woman, and I'll be out of here on my ass, and hell, I'm making, you know, $1,400 a week. I have to work 65 hours a week to get it, but, you know, $1,500 a week is $1,500 a week, and I'll just go with the flow. That's the reality. That's the way it works. I've been organizing for a lot of years, and I know the mentality, and I know that companies realize that all they have to do is hang one or two of the troublemakers from the yardarm, and that will generally do the trick. Not always, because sometimes they overreach, and that's happened a lot of times too, and people get really pissed, and suddenly the company has to give ground. They either, there's a recent occurrence, I won't say what company, they've unilaterally cut benefits, and people got really bent out of shape about it. And in one case, a couple of years ago, company cut benefits by 50%. They turned around and organized it. And the company pushed back, and they were doing a lot of work, subcontracting work, for a large conglomerate, a large entertainment conglomerate. And the entertainment conglomerate, they were basically boxed in. They had deadlines to meet. The conglomerate came to them and said, and I was involved in this, said, you settle up with these folks and you do what you have to do. Because if you miss any deadline, you're going to be in deep trouble. So the company was kind of stuck. They were between a rock and a hard place. And the employees were telling them explicitly, you don't do what we want, we're walking. And they were in a position where they didn't have a lot of places to go. So they caved. And it doesn't always happen that way. But it's, you know, I have done this long enough that I have one, I don't believe in fair and unfair. I believe in leverage. If you have the leverage to get what you want, you'll get it. Jack Nicholson got $25 million for doing the Joker. He negotiated a real sweet deal on the first Batman movie, directed by Tim Burton. And I had an executive from Warner Brothers say years ago, "Oh, you know, well, you know, we were able to push back on a few of the smaller points, and, you know, and but he had the leverage to get a really sweet deal. Now you can argue that's unfair; it's not the way it should be, you know. But they wanted him badly enough. He was the guy that they had to have, and he took advantage of the situation. Same thing as." If you've got a skill set in the CG world that they desperately need, you're the only one that really knows that piece of software backwards and forwards or whatever it is, you negotiate a good deal for yourself. You negotiate extra vacation. You negotiate better hours. You negotiate high pay. Now, that might change as more people come into the talent pool that can do the same thing that you can do, but I have certainly seen in years gone by, people that had a skill set that was in very short supply, and those people ended up doing very well for themselves. The only thing I'll say is that that isn't a situation that lasts through time, because generally, if there's a skill set that is in short supply and therefore very well compensated, other people figure that out and get that same skill set. And as more people flood in to that area of work, then the wages will come down because you're not in, you know, the same amount of demand. Of course, if you're Jack Nicholson, there's only one Jack Nicholson, so you can negotiate what you can negotiate. But that's my whole point. It's not a matter of what's fair, what's right, what's just, what's American, what's un-American. All that stuff is really beside the point. It's what you've got the power and leverage to get. And you can do it either individually in some cases or in years gone by, and even up till now in the entertainment industry, a lot of people do it collectively. You strike, you threaten to strike, you organize, you do that to get yourself a better deal. And, you know, there's always the argument that, well, you can send the work overseas, and a lot of the work does go overseas, and then you and I know a lot of the story there is work comes back, it's crap, it's got to be redone, got to have somebody over here fixing it. And that's just the problem. The problem for the studios is it's cost-benefit. If you send the work overseas where you have less quality control over it, then the stuff comes back and it might be totally unusable. And that's the risk that you run. So it's always this calculation of risk. Also, thanks to the administration, the dollar's tanking. So basically, you're, you know, shipping the work out doesn't give you the same bang for the buck that it did, you know, 5 years ago. So, I mean, there's a lot of elements that go into it. And the thing that I always, and here's an example that I use in a related industry, the gaming industry. And Electronic Arts is huge, and they've got studios all over the world. The question that I always have for audiences is, why the hell does Electronic Arts have a large studio, double building, in Playa Vista? Is that the low-wage area? No, there's another reason that Electronic Arts has a studio with a lot of people down there, because God knows that's one of the more expensive places to put a studio, so why the hell are they doing it? Because they want the infrastructure and the talent pool that's available in the Los Angeles area. That's the reason. They're certainly not doing it because it's the low-cost area of work. So, and it's the same thing for every studio. Amagi has a big satellite studio in Los Angeles. Why is it they're a Hong Kong studio? Well, because they want to draw on the talent pool that's in Los Angeles. They want the story artists, they want some of the modelers and designers, and they've got a fairly sizable studio over in Sherman Oaks. But why the hell is that? Hong Kong is a much lower cost provider, and if they moved out of Hong Kong to, say, Shanghai, it'd be even lower cost. Because cost isn't the only driver. If cost were the only driver, you know, everything would be in Mumbai, India.
Right.
But it isn't. because there's a lot of other elements that go into doing this work.
Right. Well, that's been my, you know, it's going to be a global market. There's no way to change that. There's no way to fight that. You just got to carve out your niche and be strong in that niche. And proximity sometimes can be a very big advantage to, you know, especially on these larger movies where a visual effects supervisor has to oversee multiple houses. You know, it's very tough to do remotely, and you can't beat the interaction directly with humans.
But that's the whole point. You can't job this stuff out and expect a good result. And so then they have a, you know, well, we can do it overseas for half the cost, but it'll be crap, and then we'll probably have to redo it. So do we want to run the risk?
Well, and more importantly, too, these days is the deadline shrinking so tightly that you can't afford that time lag if you do have repair something.
That's another point. You can't miss the release date, right. So you'll spend an extra $1 million to hit your release date, because an extra million in the course of the entire film, where the budget's $130-140 million, is nothing.
Right.
It's 0.5%. And if you miss the weekend that you've got it to open, you're cooked.
Right.
You can't do it. So that's why it won't happen.
Right. Well, let me ask you a question. Everything you're talking about seems like just stuff that needs to happen, that, you know, you don't go onto a stage and have people that work unlimited hours without being compensated for it. There's very strict rules and break times and, you know, lunch penalties and all that kind of stuff. Most of the other parts of the business are very well protected in that way. And yet,
but they're not as well protected, even unionized areas. You know, the companies will swallow the overtime charges and work people 18 hours a day.
Right.
Now people are making a ton of money.
Right.
But you've got situations where, one example is when Billy Crystal was filming 61, which was about the Roger Maris home run season, and when he hit 61 home runs, they were shooting late, and people were dropping, and they were getting paid overtime. And Billy Crystal drove home and fell asleep driving and almost wrecked his car, and, you know,
well, there was a crew member killed on a set in Los Angeles driving home from a long day, and that caused a big uproar for about a month, and then I never did anything about it again. You know, it was this whole thing about changing the rules
I've been in convention settings where there've been screaming matches between the head of the union and crew members. I mean, the problem becomes you get caught up in the moment. And the studios, see, overtime is basically something that was put in place not so much so that an individual crew member would make a lot of money in a given week. Overtime was originally set up so that there would be a financial incentive not to overwork people.
Right.
That's why overtime is there to a large extent. Because the thinking was, and it held for a long time, oh, well, if they have to pay double for a week's work by working extra hours, they won't do it because, you know, they'll want to avoid the extra charge. But what's happened is budgets are so high and deadlines are so tight and release windows are so solid that, and, you know, set in concrete, that it's just a matter of, oh, get it done. We have to throw another $1 million at it. We'll do it. And that's the problem. And so all these mechanisms that were put in place to sort of discourage long hours don't work. You still have the long hours. It's just that people make a whole lot of money. And what's generally done with crew is on live action crews, you know, they'll give them the option of renting them a hotel room close by so that, you know, they can, you know, walk half a block and just go to sleep in a bed, not try and drive home after 18 hours on a set. But this kind of stuff still happens. Hmm. And I don't know, you know, I don't know how you prevent certain practices from happening, because everybody remembers, you know, the Twilight Zone thing.
Mm-hmm.
The kids and the actor getting decapitated when the helicopter crashed. Well, I mean, the reality was they were violating state laws about employing children that late at night. They were in total violation, and they were cheating. And that's my whole point. That was 20-something years ago. That kind of stuff goes on a regular basis because the state of California and or the federal government doesn't have the manpower or the energy to enforce its own regulations, and generally doesn't. And so companies make the calculation that, well, what are the odds that we're going to get caught? The odds are real low. And what happens if we do get caught? Let's pay a small fine. Oh, okay, we'll do it then. Because they just analyze it for cost benefit. And so what has to change over time is the culture. And the culture, I mean, if you have people in a studio, when I started the business in the 1970s, the culture was a lot different in animation than it is today. There was far less violations of overtime. There was far less pressure to, you know, work off clock and just get it done. Sure, you're cheating. I mean, a lot of my job at Energy goes into trying enforcing violations of the contract for overtime, you know. And a lot of times it's hard because if people, for instance, take the work home, how do you police that? You just can't. So you do the best you can. You take your shots. You tamp it down over there. But a lot of times you're like a guy with a damp towel in a raging forest fire. You beat the flames out right in front of you around that tree there, but the rest of the forest is still on fire. And that's generally what happens even with non-union visual effects houses. They might be violating labor regs right and left, but who is around that's going to enforce them? Certainly not the employees. They're just trying to keep their heads above water. Right. A lot of them don't know the regs anyway.
Well, yeah, that's very important, and I would love to get a complete... I'm going to try to talk to somebody from the state about just kind of what is the general... I'm kind of focused on California right now, but our audience is global. But I really want to get a definition of exactly what is expected and what is required by the companies, because a lot of companies are using, you know, way more freelancers on a permanent basis. They're having people set up, you know, companies to try to get around stuff.
And there was a story in the news a couple of days ago. One of the contractors in Iraq, the government's saying, well, you know, they're going to have to pay. They're not going to be able to get around paying certain employee taxes. And so the response of some of these companies that are getting taxpayer dollars is, oh, we'll just make everybody a subcontractor. Then they have to pay all of their own taxes. We're not even going to have them on the books as employees.
Which I think is becoming more and more common in visual effects these days.
Yeah, exactly. And it's probably certainly a violation of the spirit, if not, in every case, the letter of the law, because, you know, the IRS several years ago did a real crackdown on companies that were trying to employ people, not as employees, but saying that they were independent contractors. The IRS has a fairly stringent set of guidelines, which is if you're being supervised, if you're using the equipment of the company, if you're in the company on the company's premises, if they're insisting on corrections and you're making them, you're being treated as an employee. And so a lot of times, and I've encountered this in my little area of the work, there are people who have been classified independent contractors, and it was just wasn't even close. But they try and do it anyway. But
well, what changes that? Obviously, I think one of the big driving factors is if somebody along the line, the IRS, the state, workman's comp, if somebody's not making their dollar that they're supposed to be making, that usually raises a red flag.
Right. Well, and the other thing that raises a red flag, somebody goes and files a complaint with the California Labor Commissioner, and then they'll investigate in a lot of instances, hold a hearing. Another thing that might do it is IRS does an audit. For unionized work, what does it is the trust funds will look at people who are companies that are claiming somebody is an independent contractor and say, nah, you owe hours on these people. We're not going to let you get away with that. Hmm. And you know, all that stuff taken together has an effect. Also, a lot of times, and this has happened, if the market's tight, somebody comes in and they say, we're going to use you as an independent contractor. No, I need my benefits. I'm going to only work as an employee. And then it's a matter of the company's in a position where they need this person to work for them. And if they can't get them to do it as an indie, then, okay, we'll hire you as an employee. I've seen that happen. It, you know, it all comes down to the fear on the part of the company, whether, A, they can get away with it, are they going to get caught, are they over the line. A lot of times, there's a, if it's a large company, the company lawyer will say, you can't do that. There have been animation companies a couple of decades ago when I first started doing this. We forced them to pay overtime on a number of people by filing a lawsuit. We settled. We never got to court. But I think it probably changed their behavior down the road. And the thing is, they weren't even paying production assistants that they were paying $200 or $300 a week to, who were working 60 to 80 hours a week. They weren't paying them overtime, and they weren't making enough wages so that they were even making the minimum wage with the extra hours they were working. So they were doing, they had a twofer. They weren't paying overtime and they weren't even paying the minimum wage. So, you know, all this kind of stuff comes into play. And the company, at some point, if somebody blows the whistle, and this is the problem for every company, you know, employees, especially when they're laid off, suddenly get real brave and get real angry and have nothing to lose, and suddenly will go and either file a lawsuit or go to the California Labor Commissioner or do something that will have bad blowback for the company. I've dealt with companies where I have caught them. And it wasn't the company itself, but it was a production manager on a show that was not paying overtime and had people working 12, 14 hours. And I would go to the company attorney, and they would say, we can't have this happening. And they would reprimand the production manager and immediately pay the overtime. They're not doing it because they're altruistic, because they know the company is at risk if they let this stuff go on,
right.
And they can have bigger fines and bigger payments that they need down the line. It's just good business sense to make it clean. That's what attorneys generally do. If it's something that's way over the line and they have any kind of knowledge of what can happen, they're going to stop it because they don't want the bad ramifications that could happen if they just allow it to go on, especially when they know it's happening.
Right. Well, let me ask you, just to kind of sum up, assume that you're talking to a group of, you know, tens of thousands of visual effects artists out there who listen to our podcasts. What would be your advice in terms of moving forward in the business? How should they approach their own work, and how should they think about this in terms of how it affects them, and how could they move forward solving these problems?
Well, I think the first thing that they need to do, and I'm not going to be self-aggrandizing here and blow my own horn and say, come join the Animation Guild or some other labor union. I'm going to make it much more basic than that. The first thing that anybody that's working in the industry should do is know what their legal rights are under law. Know what the labor regs say. Know what the company should be doing.
Where would someone go to get all that information?
Because I think it's all online. You can go to the California Labor Commission, California Gov. You look at the regs, and that's where you start. And then you can take it further than that by, you know, talking to your peers. And then you take it further than that by simply doing informal organizing, not even thinking about necessarily joining a labor union to begin with, but doing gentle pushback. I mean, there are such laws as, you know, you've got turnaround times. You know, you can't work endlessly, you know, 18 and 20 hours a day without breaking labor regulations, either federal or state. And, you know, because there's rest periods, There's another example, and I get this from companies that we have contracts with. You know, they get into a crunch, and they say, oh, we're going to have a working lunch. Well, no, that's not a lunch. The motion picture regs, I looked at it a couple of days ago, say that after 6 hours, you have to take at least a half-hour meal break. Now, how many visual effects artists you know, gobble a sandwich at their desk and go right on working? They're violating the labor reg. You know, the companies can dance around it, say, well, you know, they don't understand the business, we've got a deadline, blah, 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 but they're violating labor regs. Now, what's the downside? There really isn't any downside because they're probably not going to be called on it or get caught. But they're still breaking the law, you know. O.J. Simpson probably offed two people, but he got away with it. So, you know, he's still out there playing golf or whatever. Or maybe he's in jail soon. Who knows? But I'm not talking about what people can get away with. I'm saying what the law is, what the regulation is, and that if you're going to be in the business and you're going to be in the business long term, know what those labor regs are. Do some research. It would take a couple of hours. And just, you know, find out for yourself, because knowledge, you know, is your first line of defense. And usually you're talking to a production manager who really doesn't know. He's parroting what somebody else has told him, and it's probably wrong about what the regs are. And somebody that knows, I mean, another basic one, and this happens at companies all the time, sharing wage information. It's a protected right under California labor regs. You have the right to share wage information. How many visual effects houses that you know say to their top guys, keep it to yourself what you're making? It's against the law. It's against the law. You can tell anybody, and the law is explicit. The law says you can neither be disciplined nor discharged for sharing wage information. And the number of companies in this town that basically have a production guy saying, you know, we'd really appreciate it. We'd really like it if you don't tell anybody what you're making. It goes on all the time. And the problem with that is they're nudging right up against the law, because even though they're saying we'd appreciate it, and they can go back and alibi and say, well, we didn't tell them they couldn't. We just told them that we'd appreciate it if they didn't do it. Well, if you're an employee talking to a manager who's telling you across his desk, we'd appreciate it if you didn't do so-and-so. Yeah, maybe technically they're not ordering you, but the intimidation factor is heavy. And in fact, the people that I've advised about this, usually a manager that knows anything about the law will immediately back off when somebody says, well, I'm uncomfortable with that because that's... you're telling me to do that is a violation of law. Oh, well, you know, they'll suddenly back way off. But they're going to try it because it serves their economic self-interest. If they don't have to deal with employees that know what other people around them are making, it's better for them because they can negotiate lower rates. And it's but that's what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is if people know all this, then they're not going to have their rights trampled on, and they're not going to get railroaded into things that otherwise they'll be railroaded into.
Sure. And I would,
if you don't know, you'll go along with it.
Right. And I would guess that companies have separate different deals with multiple people. You know, everybody's on that different deal, which is also very odd.
Well, and the song and dance is always, well... You know, and this is what usually companies say. Well, you know, it's really going to hurt morale if you go around telling people that you're making, you know, $3,000 a week. No, it's not going to hurt morale. It's going to make it more difficult for the company to negotiate other lower salaries with other people. You know, yep. It's like that's what it is. And besides, it's not an individual employee's, you know, they're not the keeper of the corporate morale. So why is it their responsibility to... you know, walk away from their own self-interest, you know, in order to help out the company? I mean, it's silly.
Right.
especially when it's in violation of law.
Right.
You know? And that's the thing that people don't sit and think about. If they're told by a manager, well, don't do so-and-so, well, this is just the way it is, well, you know, 14-hour days are the norm, well, the 10-hour is a norm production day, and we're not paying any overtime, and that's just the way it is. Most people, if they're young, if they don't spend any time knowing what the regs are, go, oh, okay, and they just go with the flow. Most people, under most ordinary circumstances, go with the flow.
Well, you're in a tough spot when you're looking for a job and you're talking to somebody and they say, well, we pay, you know, it's a 10-hour day or a 12-hour day or whatever it might be, and you're kind of hard put to say, well, isn't California labor law 8 hours? I mean, I guess that's what you should be doing.
Oh, you don't tell them up front to get the job. You're not going to argue the fact when you're trying to get hired. You argue the fact after you're in place. And also, you have no leverage. I mean, the other thing is, if you're trying to get the job and you start spouting, you know, labor codes at a guy who's potentially going to hire you, they're not going to hire you. A, because, I mean, beyond the fact that you know too much, which is the underlying issue, but the studio bullcrap rationale will be, well, he seems like a troublemaker, he's not a team player. You know, basically a team player is somebody who knuckles under. That's what most corporate definitions, and that's a little unfair because a lot of times a team player, somebody who's pleasant, gets along with his peers, you know, goes the extra mile. All that stuff is true. But a lot of times when they say he's not a team player, what they mean is he stands up for himself. And it's all, you know, politics are always different at every studio. I mean, at one studio, the strike zone of what you can do and what you can't do is much bigger than at another studio. It always, and it changes at every studio. I just posted about this 3 or 4 days ago on the blog about the political realities and the way it works at most animation houses, and it applies almost in equal measure to visual effects houses. And I go through, I run the whole gamut, you know. Gigs are temporary. That's point one. Visual effects, everybody knows that. But then there's also the thing that even if you've been around a long time and you get a manager who says, oh, we're going to have a forum, you know, I want everybody to ask questions. If there's any problems, my door is always open. I mean, anybody who's been around for any length of time knows that's what they're saying. But what they mean is, you know, stay the hell away from my office and don't give me any trouble. That's what they really mean. And I can name you studios where they've said, oh, it's a new day here, it's a new regime, we want to know what the problems are, and just come on in. And the people that do are gone after a short time. And I quote Catch-22 in the piece.
And people can find that at animationguild.org, and there's a blog section, right? That's where they would go, because I did look around at the site before we talked, and there's quite a bit of information on there.
Oh yeah, well, it's just because I put things up every day, and the thing that happens, and I'll pull it up. I'll pull up this quote from Joseph Heller because it's a great one. What Joseph Heller says, this is straight out of Catch-22, and I lead into it by saying, politics is always part of the job. Over the years, studio artists have trooped into my office and proclaimed, I don't play politics. And I always have the same reply. Sure you do. If you're breathing, you're playing. The only question is, are you playing good? Are you playing bad? Are you playing average? Every studio has politics. If you're a superstar, most of it bounces off of you, as long as you stay a superstar. For everybody else, they need a modicum of competence, because if they're incompetent, no amount of apple polishing will save them. And the ability to play well with others. The other unhappy part of politics in the studios, the strike zone is always changing. What's perfectly okay under one management team is forbidden under the next. Often you don't find this out until you're standing in line at the unemployment office muttering, what the bleep? Those new breath of fresh air top kicks who seem so open, so above board, the ones who have employee forums where they welcome the questions, remember the words of Joseph Heller, and this is where I quote Catch-22. I want someone to tell me, Lieutenant Shishkov beseeched them all prayerfully. This is an officer's meeting. If any of it's my fault, I want to be told. He wants someone to tell him, Clevenger said. He wants everyone to keep still, idiot, Yasarian answered. But didn't you hear him? Clevenger argued. Oh, I heard him, Yasarian replied. I heard him say very loudly and very distinctly that he wants every one of us to keep our mouths shut if we know what's good for us. I won't punish you, Lieutenant Shishkov swore. He says he won't punish me, said Clevenger. He'll castrate you, said Yasarian. That was written in 1955, and he was writing about officer meetings, satirizing them, from World War II. And guess what? Nothing has changed.
Well, Steve, I thank you for this.
Well, you're very welcome.
Well, fascinating interview. I mean, I've got to admit, I'm a little skeptical at times when you start talking about unions and things like that, having seen some bad aspects of unions. But I think some of the stuff that he's talking about, again, is really important. And once again, we mentioned it in the intro. He obviously, in his Animation Guild, has a very U.S., especially even L.A.-focused. I mean, he doesn't even talk about Chicago, I guess, for a lot of this, where we're experiencing the same problems. But obviously, that impacts just stuff where, you know, in London, there are tons of great artists in London, for instance, and there are a lot of jobs that are being shipped out of London as well. So, again, I think it depends where you're standing from. I don't think it's intended to knock against the high-quality visual effects that are being done all around the world. But, again, a fascinating stuff that he brings up, Jeff.
Yeah, and very universal. I mean, a lot of the things he discusses have nothing to do with the union, just basically about leverage and about negotiations and about working conditions. And more importantly, knowing what is right and what is wrong when it's asked.
Exactly.
It's a difficult position to be in. One thing that I think that this brought up for me was, and it came out of SIGGRAPH as well, was I was talking to an artist who was telling me that he really wanted to get in to do Match Move, and somebody told him, oh, you know, don't even bother getting into Match Move and Roto, because both those are going to be outsourced completely. And he was kind of, you know, upset about that and heartbroken, and I started thinking about it, going, well, wait a minute. You know, all of the young talent in a major, in a growing facility always comes out of those departments. I mean, people come in, they do Roto for a while, and they, you know, show their chops, and then they move, you know, get promoted from there into other areas. And it kind of wonder, you do kind of wonder about the future of growth.
That's so true. That's so true. We talked about that. I think this is the same person, the FXPHD member that we know exactly is working through path like that at a post house. They started out doing Roto, joined there, have been taking our class at PhD since we started, and now we're working their way up through the compositing chain. And this is not in LA. Again, this is outside the United States. So this is the kind of stuff that goes on. And if the kind of outsourcing stuff where all those entry level positions ended up being shifted to a factory place somewhere else where they're just throwing a ton of artists on it, that's where the real danger is. We're not going to have a way to bring up junior artists through the system, I don't think. That's the way we've done it over the years, and I think it's actually really quite effective. It's a great way to demo someone's talent, I think, is by starting them out on stuff like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, it takes time to develop some of those skills, and if that path is not available to someone, then, you know, I question where the talent pool comes from in your local area, you know, for the up-and-coming artist.
Or you can nurture that.
Yeah. So anyway, it brings up a lot of issues, and you know, I'm sure we'll continue following up on these in future podcasts as well.
And we mentioned again in the beginning, if you're listening to this and you're outside the United States, we'd love to hear the kind of pressures that are experiencing in other markets. We've heard them secondhand, but if you drop us a line at podcast@effectsguide.com, we'd love to hear about it. I mean, are there union stuff going on? Are there jobs in the major production markets outside the United States being shipped off, and so that, you know, maybe not going to be able to train the younger artists and nurture their talent as they moved up. We'd love to hear from you and do future podcasts about that as well, because once again, we're certainly a global site here at effectsguide.com. And again, it's just Jeff's proximity to LA. What makes sense for us to kind of start out there as a way of building to following this internationally as well.
Sure. And also, you know, people like the Animation Guild have such a large membership already, and they are very well established for, you know, a long time in the industry, that we felt it was important to talk to somebody like that to find out, you know, what they do. And because conversations do come up about, you know, well, gee, maybe visual effects should become a unionized thing. Maybe that's the only way to get respect in the industry. You know, maybe the credits won't be at the end of the movie if we have a union. I mean, so these conversations come up, so I thought it was important to go and start broaching that subject and finding out what the union does.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it was great. Well, thanks so much, Jeff, for taking the ball and running it with it on this on these labor issues things. Again, I think it's really opening up the eyes of a lot of artists that, hey, you're not alone in some of the struggles that you're going through. And to your point that this podcast with Steve, I think, actually had a lot of great tips for just freelance artists in general and keeping tabs on things and being aware of what you're getting into.
Well, knowledge is power, and that's the bottom line. And I think that's what I took away from that conversation with him was, you know, the internet opens up a lot of resources for us for learning in so many directions. And one of those is in, you know, find out where your area is and find out what department of what agency is responsible for, you know, labor conditions or labor laws, and find out, you know, how this works. We'll get into a little bit more of that for the state of California in the next podcast, hopefully. And, you know, but I think it really is saying to me and to every artist out there that, you know, these tools are out there. You just have to start doing some homework, and, you know, a couple hours spent searching down that information would be good for everybody.
Yeah, certainly. Well, on that note, let's close it out for this week. Again, thanks, Jeff, for the effort on this. I think it was really fascinating. And again, drop us a line if you have any questions or comments or personal experiences relating to this that we might be able to follow up on in future podcasts. But as always, thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.
Bye.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by using the Contact Us links at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright 2008 FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.